listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
Welcome to Full Power Living. We're the only show on international media that is dedicated to the exploration and understanding of emotions and their role in human life. I'm Eileen Dillon, your creator and host, and during this live broadcast, we invite you to interact with us on our chat here on the EmotionalPro.com radio page, and also you can call in toll-free at 800-630-7858. That's 800-630-7858, and that number is listed on the chat. So be sure to call if you'd like to ask our guest questions this morning. This month, we've brought you shows about dealing with the challenges of physical illnesses and conditions. Michael Merritt talked with us about a lifetime of gradual vision loss for him and four of his brothers. Wired Magazine executive editor Thomas Goetz shared what medicine of the future could be like, including how we deal with the information of possible genetically based chronic illnesses. And last week we talked with Heather Carriou about her beautifully written memoir, 65 Roses, of the impact her sister's cystic fibrosis had on her lifetime and, in fact, the whole family. And this week we're taking a longer look at chronic illness as we're joined by therapist, professional speaker, and rheumatoid arthritis sufferer, and Dr. Ann Steiner. Together, we're taking a look at the roller coaster of chronic illness with emphasis on how to add joy to the ride. We think these programs are important for you even if you're quite healthy. Nearly one in three people in the United States has been reported to suffer from chronic illness. That's 90 million people. This means that if you yourself don't have chronic illness, your neighbor, your father, your friend, or your coworker likely does. For them, in addition to the stresses of today's economy or the ecological conditions or fast-paced living or the political machinations, they cope with pain, inconvenience, feelings of helplessness, embarrassment, and limitation on an ongoing basis. And I think when we understand their situations better, we're more able to be compassionate and to offer appropriate help and to contribute to their lives so that they have even more joy. And as it always happens, so will we. And should you ever develop such issues yourself, you'll be able to follow the model offered to us by our guest, Ann Steiner. You can find Dr. Steiner at drsteiner.com. She's a former wheelchair user and has for decades been active in the self-help and disability rights communities. Her inspiring story was featured in the book Believing in Ourselves, A Celebration of Women, along with those of other such notable women as Sonia Sotomayor, now a Supreme Court Justice, Antonio Novello, former Surgeon General of the United States, and Marty Evans, National Executive Director of the Girl Scouts of America. Ann Steiner has given lectures, workshops, and speeches about the emotional aspects of chronic illness throughout the U.S. for such groups as the American Group Psychotherapy Association, the Arthritis Foundation, the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation, the International Human Learning Resources Network, and Kaiser Hospital. Now, she has a CD, The Roller Coaster of Chronic Illness, How to Add Joy to the Ride, and that's where, with humor and plain language, she inspires people with practical advice about how to address the specific needs of someone suffering from chronic pain and physical limitation so they can have fuller lives and better lives. She got her PhD in clinical psychology from the California School of Professional Psychology in Berkeley and served for 14 years as an associate clinical professor at the University of California, San Francisco in the Department of Psychiatry. Dr. Ann Steiner, it's an honor and a pleasure to welcome you here to Full Power Living.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
May I call you Ann on our program today?
Of course.
Great. Well, I think most people don't do a lot of thinking about chronic illness. And we don't know the extent of it in our society. We don't know what it takes to adjust to it until or unless somebody we love, including ourselves, may be diagnosed with an illness. And that, I think, limits our compassion. So talk to us a little bit about the situation of chronic illness that's all around us and among us.
That's a really good question. You know, chronic illness, as you mentioned, the statistics, is really out there in big numbers. And with the baby boomers, we're going to be seeing much larger numbers of people dealing with chronic illnesses. And I think before I talk more in detail about your question about where it is in our world, it's worth looking at the continuum of the different types of chronic illness.
Great.
Because it's actually a fairly broad continuum, and one is that it starts out usually as being something acute that's pretty severe and disturbing and life-disrupting. It could involve a hospitalization. I would say, on average, the majority of the people that I work with it took them 3 years to get what I think of and they think of as being awarded a diagnosis for their chronic illness.
Wow.
It often takes a long time to get an answer. So often it'll start out as acute, then it becomes chronic. And there are different categories of chronic. One is that there's chronic that's life-altering and disruptive. Then there's chronic progressive, like with Parkinson's. There's chronic relapsing and remitting, as in multiple sclerosis, which has many different forms and levels of severity. Chronic life-threatening things like cystic fibrosis, as Heather Carew talked about with her sister last week. And then terminal, where it's the person's life is definitely going to be less than 6 months, say, if they're going to be going into hospice. So there's a wide range of different types of chronic illness, and within each disease, there are many categories. So one of the big challenges is to look at the generalizations that apply to all illnesses, as well as the generalizations that don't. And one of the generalizations that doesn't apply is it actually does apply, is that they're not all the same. You could have the exact same diagnosis, and it'll affect everybody differently based on your life history and how you deal with problems and the amount of support you have and all of that stuff.
That's true. Heather Carew last week told us that both her sister and her brother were diagnosed with cystic fibrosis, but her brother had a less severe case, and he was able to do much, much more.
Yeah, and that complicates things a lot. I gave a keynote address, I think, maybe 10 years ago for the Cystic Fibrosis Research Institute in Northern California, and I've been involved with them ever since then. And so I'm intimately related, you know, in terms of seeing people go through that particular illness, which is a life-threatening illness. It used to be people had that disease, were diagnosed with it, they were going to die before they were 12. Mm-hmm. And now we have people coming to the conference that have never seen anybody else at 65 and doing pretty well. So it's a wide range again.
Wow. I saw on Everybody's Got Talent last night, I think, two sisters with cystic fibrosis who were singing, who did a great job. Two young girls.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Still had braces on their teeth.
What a kick.
Yeah. So that's really good. And, you know, having just read about it, I know how difficult it is to be singing when you have problems with your lungs. So that brings up a good point, though. Chronic illness, we can experience or have chronic illness at any time through the life cycle. You had problems before your teen years with arthritis, but didn't really know what you were working with until 14, is that right?
Right, yeah. It took them a long time. When I was about 9, I think they took me to a pediatric rheumatologist or somebody like that, and he said, well, maybe, but nobody really knew. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I was 14 that I was diagnosed. They called it growing pains, all kinds of other things, but it took quite a long time as a child, and at that time, people really weren't as aware that, you know, arthritis hits children. There are children born with arthritis,
right.
And they didn't know that there were 110 types of arthritis. So it was a different world back then.
But despite whatever stage of life you develop a chronic illness, there are emotional things that a person goes through, and I'd like you to tell us some of the stages. I assume we go through the stages of grief, for example. What kinds of emotions do we encounter with chronic illness?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really, I like to start most of my talks pretty early on talking about this, so it's a great question. One of the best pieces of work on this was done by Dr. Joanne LeMaitre, who's actually down at Stanford, and she wrote a fabulous book called, at the time it was called Beyond Rage, and then they changed the name of the book. What she came up with was she has these five, six stages, and the first stage is crisis. During the crisis stage, everybody in the family and the social network is all mobilized. It's when people would be doing their casserole brigade, and there's a lot of support. After the crisis passes and it becomes clear that it's a chronic illness, people tend to move into more isolation. The people that were involved in the dramatic stuff tend to back off. That's the time when people tend to lose their friends, because some friends really cannot tolerate having a friend with limitations that changes the ability to do things that they used to do together. It really requires a lot of negotiation. And at that time, often patients aren't aware of all the different challenges they need to deal with. So they sort of go within themselves. And if their friends can't hang in there during that time, they tend to get more isolated. And then they tend to move into what Dr. LeMaitre calls the anger stage. And that's a time that's pretty normal and understandable about being angry. You get a lot of the why me and all of that. And again, that can push people away when you stay stuck in the angry stage. The next stage that she talks about that's really helpful is she calls it reconstruction. The way I think about it is that you're rebuilding your life during that time. And during that time of rebuilding, you're pulling out pieces of where you used to be, what used to be important to you, that you can still do, that you still do. And then all of a sudden, out of the blue, you'll get knocked down with depression. And this, I think, is one of the biggest contributions that she made, because before her work, everybody, including therapists, were using the Kubler-Ross model of death and dying that was very linear. And what she talks about instead is a phase of intermittent depression. And that is a normal phase that happens. And when you have chronic illness and chronic pain, intermittent depression is going to come back up periodically. It tends to get triggered when you have a setback. If you get into a car accident, you have a major loss in your life, that depression is going to come back up. Personally, the way I think about it is that there's an underground river of depression that's just constant and permanent when you've got a lifelong illness. But it may not be a big part of your life. It's a little bit like an underground river that every now and then overflows. And if you look at it that way, then it doesn't throw you off quite as badly when it hits. You just know, going in, that you're going to have those times when it hits, and they won't last quite as long as the first one. Some may be longer than others, but they're not permanent. It's not like a major clinical depression that we could talk about later if you want it.
Right.
And then her last stage is one of renewal, which is quite exciting, where she talks about really rebuilding your life and rebuilding your identity. And that's the major phase of moving forward. So those are the key phases and stages of progression that are really useful for people to be aware of.
Yes, they're very, it really lays it out there. I'm reminded, I hadn't thought of it till just now, for several years I worked as a therapist with a young man who had been severely injured in a playground accident, and he lost the use of his voice and his arms and his legs. And he came to a class that I offered on anger with his aide, and he could punch out messages on a little keyboard that he had in front of him, and his aide would help him to express it. And I noticed that he did fine with, to me, depression, the kind that you're talking about. Depression really is a form of anger that we hold inside. It's anger that we might have gotten in trouble for expressing, or we have feared we would have gotten in trouble for expressing when we were young. And I noticed that he did fine until he was reminded of his limitations. If he tried to do something or go someplace and he was reminded of his limitations, that's when his depression would return.
And that's one of the big challenges, is that there are constant reminders. And so what a lot of people tend to do is that sort of an automatic reflex is to automatically not go into those situations, which makes your world smaller and smaller.
Right.
And
right.
then you get depressed for your world being too small. So the challenge is to find ways to deal with the reality of your limitations without it becoming who you are and bringing you down, for lack of a better word at the moment.
Mm-hmm. And I think in your work, you do a really great job. One of the things I learned years ago is that facing the fact, mm-hmm. looking squarely at what's going on, sets you free. Mm-hmm. And I think that is something that you talk about and illustrate, is looking squarely. Okay, what is it I'm dealing with? What is it that I need to do? And that can help you so that you don't keep narrowing your world.
Mm-hmm.
Do you agree? Or
I do agree. And the one caveat I would add to that is it's an issue of timing.
Mm-hmm.
That timing is really a major factor for everybody involved with illness, therapists, family members, friends. There will be times when somebody else's timing just doesn't make sense to you.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be that it's going to take a long time for somebody to face their illness squarely, or they may go through episodes where they can deal with it, and then they go back in, and it's almost like they're chewing on it internally.
Mm-hmm.
And so it may look like they're not working on it, or they're avoiding it. And the question is, you know, where it's really going, whether you're looking at denial or that kind of thing. But the looking at what the, you know, when somebody is talking about their illness and talking openly about it, that's usually a statement that they're open to discussing and looking at it. And then, then they can take in a lot of input and support from people.
A few years ago when I was preparing for a speech I was giving, I learned about something called healthy denial.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And healthy denial actually can assist you in coping with your illness or condition, because you don't sit there and say, oh, I've got this illness and there's nothing I can do about it and I just need to give up. If you mm-hmm. deny it a little bit, then you keep pushing forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the way I think about it is that healthy, you know, the denial is an automatic built-in physiological thing that happens that is built to protect us. So when you're in a car accident, you automatically, if it's a bad one, go into shock. And most people do the appropriate wise things, sort of like on automatic pilot under crisis situations. And then after the situation passes, then it starts to seep in a little bit. But that healthy denial got them through it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's sort of an exaggerated version of that. And for different people, the amount of time they need, their own experience of healthy denial will be different than others.
Right.
And what I see often in my office is that with partners or family members, it just doesn't make sense. Why is this person doing these things on a different timeline than me is really what it boils down to.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of my job is to help people understand the differences.
Mm-hmm. Well, everybody has their own rhythm for doing things, and it must be really hard to pace another person. I actually, Monday, I think I wrote to you as we were exchanging information about the show. I spent the day on Monday with my little granddaughter, mm-hmm. who turns 2 next week and who was severely injured a couple of weeks ago on her hand. And I found myself with the luxury of pacing myself to her mm-hmm. timing all day long.
Yeah.
And it was a lovely thing to do, but I was mm-hmm. it made me aware of how much we're not able to do that most of the time in our lives.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, if you think about her in school right now,
uh-huh.
what kind of pacing would happen to accommodate her needs?
Uh-huh.
Very little.
In fact, she
having to accommodate in a normal school situation.
Right. In fact, she went back to her daycare the following day, and her mother reported that she was reluctant to go, and her face was downcast. And her mother wisely said, "Are you missing Grammy?" And she said, "Yes."
Mm-hmm.
And she took her to the gate, and they waved bye-bye to me. I was
mm-hmm.
far away. But I mm-hmm. think that it was largely because she did so love having
yeah.
the day paced to her.
Yeah. And that she knew that was possible, and that there are uh-huh. times when she will have access to it.
Right, right. Well,
you're going to be there, and that's a tremendous gift.
Yes, we'll just have to do it again.
Yeah, but she knows it's happened. That's, you know, and I have parents that feel like they didn't do a good job. And my point is, you know, your job is to make your child feel loved, and that when they need help, they can turn to you. And mm-hmm. if you've given them that gift, you may not be able to give them what they want right when they want it all the time, but if they know that you will listen, then they can go through a week of school like your granddaughter will, knowing that she'll be able to say, I want to see Grammy again.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the chances are it's going to happen pretty soon within her asking it.
That's true.
It's a great gift.
They can't keep me away.
Okay, well, but that's it's reciprocal, and that helps
right.
everybody.
Right, right.
You know, it's wonderful.
Well, we're up to our first break already, so we're talking today with Dr. Ann Steiner, and Ann, when we come back, I want you to talk about the grief and grieving process when people are diagnosed with chronic illness.
Mm-hmm.
Ann is a former wheelchair user who's now also a professional member of the National Speakers Association, and she helps herself and others add joy to their lives while they cope with chronic illness. You're listening to Full Power Living. I'm Eileen Dillon, and we will be right back.
You're listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
How difficult is it for you to ask directly for what you really want? To take responsibility graciously and willingly for your mistakes? Or to relate with others because it's fun instead of because you need something from them? Most people believe manipulation and codependence are normal behaviors for adults. They may be common, but they're not normal. Manipulative behaviors really are designed to be part of childhood, to be put away as things of the past when we become adults. So, if you're ready to let manipulation and codependence be part of your past, then get the mini course I've created for you, Ending Codependence, The Bottom Line. I'm Eileen Dillon, the Emotional Pro, offering you a formula that you can follow for creating healthy, manipulation-free, and lasting intimate relationships. I also give you the tools and principles that you can use to develop lasting immunity to codependence. Get Ending Codependence today at www.emotionalpro.com. That's emotionalpro.com. Welcome back to Full Power Living. This is Eileen Dillon, and I have a few announcements before we return to our conversation with Dr. Ann Steiner. First of all, I want to encourage you to download today's show to your computer or your MP3/4 device, either from our archives here at EmotionalPro.com, or you can subscribe to Full Power Living on iTunes by using my name, Eileen Dillon, I-L-E-N-E. D-I-L-L-O-N. We do have more than 300 archived Full Power Living shows here for you at EmotionalPro.com on every topic imaginable because, of course, emotions are part of everything. Now, next week, we're investigating living deeply with Dr. Marilyn Schlitz. We're delving into a decade of research done by the Institute for Noetic Sciences on the art and science of living everyday life as both a human and a spiritual being. So get your questions ready. Following shows are featuring Karis Alexander, who's going to be talking about the missing link for the law of attraction, and Chris Carlson, who's widow of Don't Sweat the Small Stuff author Richard Carlson, with a beautiful book, Heartbroken Open, sharing her path to recovering following his own untimely death. It's just a lovely model for living deeply during times of great loss and transition, which is a good follow-up on today's program, too. So check the top of our radio page here at EmotionalPro.com, and you'll see when the upcoming shows are. Also, check out my other two programs that I create and host with life coach Dakey Fox on the Women's Information Network, thewinonline.com. They are emotionally speaking and building conscious families. So thank you for your loyalty and listening. Thank you for telling your family and friends about Full Power Living and asking them to listen too. And thank you for your feedback and for being part of our mission to awaken the world to the power and importance of human emotions. Now, today we're visiting with Dr. Ann Steiner. She has a CD program entitled The Roller Coaster of Chronic Illness, How to Add Joy to the Ride. So, Ann, to me, for a woman who was wheelchair-bound, told she didn't have enough energy to even go to college, who deals daily with the pain of arthritis, you're incredibly busy. And before we delve back into the questions, I want to ask you to talk about all the ways that you are in support of other people who are on that roller coaster of chronic illness, including what's available on your website.
Okay. Well, about 10 years ago, I put together my website. Did you have a question before that?
Yeah, I was going to say, you don't have to do every single one.
I know. That would take too long. But the short version would be I get passionate about things, which I'm very fortunate about, but also can be rather derailing from other projects. But one of the things I got passionate about was when my mother became critically ill with cancer. I really felt it was a big problem with our not being able to keep track of the medications. So I put together the medical information form and made it into something that's downloadable so that people can keep track of their medications, keep a copy on their computer, and whenever they see the doctor, add a change to their medication and bring it in and have a copy in their wallet at all the times. It folds up to the size of a credit card. And that was really the impetus for my starting the website, which grew to having all kinds of resources.
That is a wonderful tool, I do want to say. That is a wonderful tool. So thank you for putting that out.
Yeah, that's one of my babies. And so in terms of other ways in which I'm involved with the world of people dealing with limitations, I do a lot of speaking engagements. I love talking to a variety of different groups. I have a private practice where I do individual couples and group therapy. And try to do a lot of writing around ways in which people can help themselves and their loved ones deal with loss and change that goes on with chronic losses like chronic pain and chronic illness.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Now, before the break, I talked to you about grief, but I realize I also haven't asked you to tell your story. We mentioned that you are a former wheelchair user, and I think it'd be a good idea for you to talk a little bit about how that changed.
So the short version is that for me, the wheelchair was my friend, although initially I really resisted the whole idea. I was dating a guy who thought that my life would be a lot better if I could get out of the apartment more. And he was a former race car driver and got me my first wheelchair, and I found I didn't like being pushed around in any metaphor or reality way. And so I ended up getting an electric wheelchair. And this is part of what's in my upcoming book, is my story, as well as some of the ways that I found that helped people. But basically, my parents were really concerned about how ill I was and that I was going downhill, and kept after me to get a second opinion. And I am really kind of rabid about encouraging people when they've been with a doctor for a long time and are not improving to get a second opinion from an expert.
Yes.
So this is what happened for me, was that the second opinion doctor at UC said, you know, I really think we can get you out of the wheelchair. I wasn't actually dependent on it. I was dependent on it in the respect that in order to go to the grocery store or do anything like walk a hallway, I needed the wheelchair and be able to see a movie and have a fuller life. So for me, it was my friend. At the time, I actually was for dealing with a lot of things. I was using the wheelchair. I had a sign on the back that said Wheels of Liberation when I was president of the Group Therapy Society of Northern California. And that was really because, for me, it was a gift. It gave me the world back. And then I gradually was able to do more exercise, build up my stamina. Probably I went into a remission, And so my concern when I tell this story is I always get concerned that people will compare themselves to me or have their Aunt Martha call them and say, well, why can't you do the same thing she did? And I don't want to be in the category of what the disability rights people call a super crip, which is the person who climbs Mount Everest in a wheelchair. And we don't hear about all the 15 support staff in the back and the full-time physical therapist and all the other things that they have on staff that makes it possible for them to do that. So, you know, my path was up and down. It was quite challenging. And occasionally I use a wheelchair for when I have, you know, a particular joint go out on me, as I call it. But basically, I feel very fortunate to have the new body that I used to want.
That's a lovely phrase, the new body that I used to want. That's great. I like that. Now, what about grief? Grief, it must happen over and over and over again on some level when you have a chronic illness.
Yeah, grief is such a big part of dealing with chronic illness, and it's a little bit like in the family of intermittent depression that it comes back, and with reminders and with changes. With progression and forward movement of a disease process. So one way of thinking about it, I was thinking about this beforehand because we had emailed a little bit, and it comes up that basically there are 9 different challenges or losses that I see on average. And the first one that a lot of therapists that specialize in working with medical illness see is loss of the known. That when you have a new diagnosis or the onset of a new illness or a major limitation or a big sports injury, what you already know is gone. Mm-hmm. You can't do and live life the way you used to. When you have a chronic disease that keeps going, there are continual losses of the known. So it used to be you could walk to the corner without pain, and now if you want to do things without pain, it's walking half a block. And the idea is to not give up walking half the block, but to find a way to constantly be modifying what you can and can't do. Then there's the loss of identity, which is major. The loss of social status that happens with aging and disability just normally. And then we begin to see more about the loss of the previously planned future. And this we see for family members as well as the patient. Is that we all, you know, we may not think we have a 10-year plan, but we all plan in the back of our minds to be able to still drive, to be able to still go for a short walk, do our own groceries. And whatever your limitations are, that's been altered to some degree or another. For many people, there's a loss of friendships and role. If you had to change your work identity, that's major. And with losing work, for people that have to file workers' compensation or who are off work, there's a dramatic life change and loss, and grief comes up around that, with a loss of structure and identity. And then there's the loss of independence. And we live in a world where independence is so prized. We're so just passionate about being independent to the exclusion of letting people help us at times. That's not always helpful. But those are the main 9 things that I think of in terms of the losses that come up and grief. And finding a way to deal with it is really difficult. And finding safe people to talk about it with is very challenging.
And I'm assuming that you recommend that people allow themselves to feel this grief, and that also we need to remember that while if I have a chronic illness, it's important for me to allow myself to grieve as much as I need to grieve, but also to remember that there may be people around me who will reach their tolerance for my grieving before I'm finished, and that shouldn't deter me from feeling my grief.
Right. You mentioned a whole bunch of important things there. One, I mean, most people would prefer to ignore the grief phase, to just sort of skip over it.
Yeah,
and
good luck.
It's just going to backfire, you know. It'll fester and decide to grow. So it's terribly important to acknowledge it. I'm a big fan of free writing, by which I mean writing about what's going on for you, especially for people that are isolated or whose family members have other crises going on and don't have a lot of what we think of as emotional room. for dealing with it. But it's really important to deal with grief and mourning. And writing, talking about it with people that have emotional room to hear it, and support groups can be tremendously helpful, whether they're short-term or long-term. Different places where you can give voice to it in a way that's acceptable to you. I think about, you know, dealing with a lot of these things as when you're talking about these issues to somebody that you trust is borrowing somebody's brain. And that could be a friend, a family member, or a therapist, or a clergy person. Mm-hmm. But you mentioned also that there are times when people don't have room for it and they get tired of it. And what I see more often is that people are afraid that they will burden people, so they don't mm-hmm. share what's going on. And then the people who love them feel left out and helpless. And instead of having that kind of thing continue, I suggest that people have an open discussion about it and say, look, I have a lot of toxic yuck I need to talk about occasionally, and I need to be able to gripe and moan. But I need, in order to be free to do that, I would like to make a deal with you, and that is that when there are times when you don't have room, please let me know. And when you have the energy to take it on, let me know. And it's sort of an old couples therapy technique, which is that the person who doesn't want to talk about it has the right to say, you know, now is not a good time to talk about what you want to discuss, but I will get back to you when I'm ready, right, and it needs to be within a week. Mm-hmm. And it's then that person, whoever unplugs the conversation, has to take the initiative to plug it back in.
I love hearing that. I love that technique. And I went mm-hmm. round and round with my husband about 12 years ago when we first married because I followed that plan and he didn't.
Right. No, this has to be
difficult.
A deal. Yeah, it's got to be a deal that everybody honors, and then you may need to, you know, if it's difficult to get in place and actually working, you may need to come up with consequences that are not too punitive, but maybe his favorite treat needs to get put in a cookie jar instead of eating it, or I don't know what. You know, I'm not big on food rewards and monetary punishments, but to figure out together what would be a good way to remind each other to keep on track with it.
Right.
And for some couples, it means meeting once a week to have a family planning meeting, even if it's just the two of them, or a mother and daughter.
Uh-huh. And so that ties in with your emphasis on communication. On your website, mm-hmm. on your CD, The Roller Coaster of Chronic Illness, you talk about how important it is to communicate. And this is from the point of view of the person with the chronic illness. You need to communicate with others about mm-hmm. what's going on with you, correct?
Mm-hmm. Definitely, definitely. One of the things that I love talking about is I think of it as basically figuring out what your limits are. And that's like limitations. So it's learning the language of your limitations, which is a big challenge, is figuring out what you can do today, and it may change tomorrow. That's one of the hardest things about unpredictable and fluctuating illnesses, is that it's not static. It's not permanent that from now on you'll always be able to do this activity for this long. It's going to be fluctuating. Mm-hmm. And you're the only one who knows that. It's not visible. And most chronic illnesses, by the way, are hidden. They're not visible, so that the people around you don't see what you feel. Although it may feel like it's obvious on your face, it's not usually. So you have to put it into words, and that the challenge with that is that usually you're feeling pretty lousy when you need to explain what you need.
Mm-hmm.
So especially if you can do preventive maintenance on this, like you would with oil changes on a car, is to be talking about stuff when you're feeling better and mm-hmm. sort of talk openly about how you want to manage it and explain what's going on. So then you're doing what I think of as teaching the language of limits.
Mm-hmm.
And inviting discussion and making it manageable.
Listening to you, I'm thinking this is good advice for everybody. You don't have to have
mm-hmm.
a chronic illness.
Exactly.
You know, I was just thinking that when my granddaughter was injured, the day after she was injured, I was watching myself, and I was calm, and my voice was calm, and so forth. But I turned to my husband, and I said, I know I look calm, I know I sound calm, but what I know about myself is that when something like this happens, I'm not okay inside,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and therefore I need you to be gentle with me today.
Wonderful, fantastic. I mean, that's a perfect example of somebody who's in tune with herself and able to ask for help. And mm-hmm. then you can get it. That's a beautiful example. And it also is an example of what most of us tend to do, is we automatically are able to ignore our own needs, our emotional needs, in order to be there for a loved one in an emergency. And that's really what crisis functioning is designed to do. The problem is when we stay stuck in crisis mode, we burn up all that stuff, and the people that are more into physical explanations of these things can give you the physiological cost. Mm-hmm. For example, Sapolsky, who talks about in his wonderful book, Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers, he talks about the horrible toll on our bodies of a chronic, unremitting stress.
Right.
So what you were going through was a form of stress. You were putting your needs on hold temporarily in service of being there and being able to help and not frighten your granddaughter and family. But mm-hmm. you knew that it was going to cost you and that you were going to need extra doses of gentleness.
Right.
It's a great example.
Thank you. Thank you. I felt good. We we've come up to our second break. We're talking today with Dr. Ann Steiner. You can find her at Dr. Steiner, drsteiner.com. We're talking about bringing joy to the challenge of riding the roller coaster of chronic illness. Dr. Steiner's a psychologist, a professional speaker, and an author. And you're listening to Full Power Living. We will be right back.
To Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
Everybody feels anger, but if you don't learn to deal with it, anger can mess up your life. It can cause you relationship problems, difficulties on the job, or create health problems. If you want a way to understand and work with anger that's simple yet so powerful it helps you to put an end to the specific angers that are messing up your life, then you'll want to get a copy of a mini course I've created for you entitled Reduce Anger Now. With it, I want you to be able to figure out what's stimulating the anger you feel and have an easy way to change that anger so you can dramatically reduce the anger in your life. I'm Eileen Dillon, the Emotional Pro, longtime psychotherapist, coach, and anger expert. I've helped thousands of people to master anger, and I want you to begin to become an anger master in your life. Order Reduce Anger Now at the store, www.emotionalpro.com. That's www.emotionalpro.com. We're back with Dr. Ann Steiner, talking with her about the roller coaster of chronic illness and how to bring joy to that ride. And speaking of anger, since we just heard the ad for my work, my idea is that everybody who is diagnosed with a chronic illness or condition experiences anger. You talked about that a while ago. How do you recommend that people work with the anger that comes up around chronic illness?
I think one of the most important things is to acknowledge it and to be aware that it's normal and it doesn't need to be permanent. Where people get into trouble is when, as you referred to before, when they turn the anger inwards and it can turn into depression.
Mm-hmm.
And then they can get into real trouble. And you know, if you want, I could talk a little bit about some of the pitfalls there. But basically, being aware that this is part of what's going on. And the other thing that really helps that I came up with a number of years ago is coming up with a nickname for your illness.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then you and the people who care about you can both and all be really angry at that illness rather than you. And that distinction makes a real difference. So, for mm-hmm. example, with arthritis, people often call it Arthur. So people will ask me how Arthur is treating me rather than how I am. you'll hear mm-hmm. patients with chronic illness complaining about people only ask them how they are. And they're always asking, how are you doing? Well, people are worried. Mm-hmm. And finding a way to keep people posted, give them enough information without that becoming a problem is a real challenge. Mm-hmm. And having a nickname for the illness. So, for example, with Parkinson's disease, it can be useful to come up with a nickname. Now, the nickname needs to be something not too user-friendly, because you don't, in fact, like this uninvited, unwanted illness guest that lives within either your loved one or yourself. But and you don't want it to be humorous. So it needs to be a name that's okay. So I have a friend, for example, who was diagnosed with a rare lung condition called sarcoidosis, which has these tumors in her lungs. So I suggested she come up with a nickname, which didn't make sense to her, sounded too silly. She decided to try it, and she ended up calling it Sherman. Mm-hmm. And after a while, it became very helpful because she and her family were able to get mad at Sherman. And she could get angry at Sherman and say, Sherman did it. I didn't mm-hmm. do that. And, you know, there could be a little bit of lightness around it. Right. As well as, you know, I don't know that Sherman's going to let me go to the movie tonight, so can we have you guys do a brown bag lunch with me another time instead? So that you don't give up on doing things. I know I'm switching topics here, but there's a different way of dealing with a lot of these things.
Well, that's really good. I'm reminded my sister, Cariac, lived with us for the last 7 months of her life. She had ovarian cancer, and amazingly, 7 weeks before she died, she was a dancer. She did an hour-long performance 2 nights in a row. Mm-hmm. She called it The Last Dance, and she presented the ravages of cancer on her body, on her dancer's body. And after she pointed out all the things that had changed and the challenges she was having, she walked right up in front of the audience and looked audience members in the eye and said, "Don't you make me into an object. I'm still in here."
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you're addressing
here. She articulates perfectly what a lot of people feel, whether it's a life-threatening illness, terminal, or an irritating, mild chronic illness. Is that you don't want to be made into that illness. That's not all of who you are.
Right.
And when you get clinically depressed, you may feel like that's all you are because all you're doing is running around to doctors trying to get pain relief and a diagnosis, and your life becomes going from doctor to doctor. And you can get caught up in that really easily, and the doctors treat you like a patient. That becomes your identity. It's a big challenge to not get caught up in that and lose your identity to becoming that, as opposed to your sister was able to hold on to being a dancer who happened to have cancer.
Right, right. And she did such a beautiful job. I asked her if I could offer it to hospice once she wasn't here anymore. And she looked at me and she said, "Well, it's okay, but I don't want to be known just for this one dance."
I love it. Yeah. That's great.
Uh-huh.
So she really got it. And what's wonderful there is, again, she was able to say that to you. Whereas people that don't feel safe to talk openly and don't feel that they will be respected wouldn't feel free enough to say to their sister that. They would just say, well, they might not want it. Right? Mm-hmm. They wouldn't be direct. They might not know what it is about that makes them uncomfortable. But not only was she aware of what was going on within her, but she knew she could trust you to be honest. So that's another wonderful example. That's great.
Okay. On the chat, we have a question that just came up. I'm curious to hear more about dealing with the kind of aches and troubles of aging. Not so much illness, but just the one thing after another chronic declines that come and go for some people more frequently as we age.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
Great question. The dealing with that stuff is, again, the main antidotes that I think of are creativity and flexibility, because it probably isn't the same every day. It may respond differently to how much sleep she's gotten. I'm assuming this is a woman.
It is, yes.
For some reason.
It is.
And,
right.
So it probably fluctuates. So knowing that helps to be able to be clear that it's going to fluctuate. And these aches and pains of aging and, that's not severe, tend to get minimized. But if they get listened to, then you can manage it more effectively. And by listened to, I mean paying attention to what makes it worse, trying to pace yourself, getting a diagnosis helps. It may be what they call osteoporosis, which happens to most women over 40, and it's a form of arthritis that most of us get. And if you listen to pain as a warning signal and you allow yourself to move forward, that helps. The other thing that really helps is a tool I came up with a number of years ago. The acronym is PEPI. It's the Pain Energy Price Index.
Oh, I was going to ask you about that. Good.
Okay. Should I talk about that now?
Please,
okay.
Yes.
Because it seemed to me that could be a useful tool for her, where you figure out what are the activities that you enjoy doing on one side of the paper. In the middle side of the paper, you write, what does it cost you in physical pain? And then the last column is it worth it to you? And so, for example, I'm just imagining for this audience member, perhaps she used to be able to go for longer walks without any aches and pains. And now she needs, if she's going to go for, and she loves going for long walks, let's say, without thinking about watching where every step goes, she may now need to go for shorter walks and sit and take a break and enjoy visiting with a friend instead of having, the pleasure of being unfettered with just walking as long as you wanted, which was how she used to be able to do it. Or in my case, you mentioned your sister loved to dance. One of my big passions is dancing. So, and it costs a fair amount for me to dance. So I rest up beforehand, and there are times, depending on how my body is doing, I might even bring an ice bag with me when I go to where I'm going, and I might sit down and ice my knee. Mm-hmm. And it would look funny, and who cares? I'll be able to dance. Part of this is letting go of what it looks like to other people, and that's not a minor thing. and letting yourself acknowledge your limitations, figuring out what the cost is, and saying, okay, I'm going to do it anyway. And there may be some things that aren't worth it. So that's one suggestion.
All right. That's really very thought-provoking. I got kind of lost in the thinking about it. One of the things you do is you reframe the term caregiver to care partner.
Right.
And I really like that. Can you explain what your motive is for emphasizing that?
Yeah, this is really a very important issue. And it's complicated because it doesn't really apply to everybody. But there's a continuum, again, depending on the illness, injury, the level of aches and pains or whatever, from which you need to give and receive care. The care partner means that your partner is in it with you. And I think from what I've heard in listening to your radio shows and knowing you, is that you're really somebody that, especially as a therapist, really values teamwork.
Yes.
Well, a marriage is teamwork, and when one partner or one family member becomes ill, the other people's relationship with them changes, and it's very easy for it to automatically slip into giving up the romantic, intimate, sexual, loving relationship with a partner and become a caregiver. And there are times with economics where that has to happen. But whenever we can have our partner be a care partner rather than a caregiver, we need to maximize those times. And there will be times in our lives, if you're going to have a long-lived marriage, where you will be caretaking each other at different times. But the whole idea is to reduce dependence, increase independence wherever it's appropriate, and really bring in one's being an active participant in one's own care, both with doctors and at home.
Also, I'm thinking, like in our Building Conscious Families program and show and work, we emphasize how children and parents are partners with each other. Mm-hmm. And at work, I think, when you're partnering to get a job done, or in mm-hmm. therapy, I partner with my clients. I don't mm-hmm. take on their job, and I don't lay my life out on them, but we're partners in helping them to live a better life. Mm-hmm. I think that partnership actually enhances a person's self-esteem
yeah.
and their growth.
Mm-hmm.
So that
it's
they actually feel better.
Mm-hmm. And it brings out the best in them, which is an important concept, mm-hmm. is that a lot of the best may have gotten forgotten and it may need to be recreated in a different way. They may not be able to do things the way they used to, but some of the talents that they used in other areas get brought into this. So, for example, a lot of times people will say to me, well, I don't know anybody that has my same illness, so nobody can help me. And my point is, if you've got people that care about you and good at problem solving, if you explain to them what the dilemma is, then and invite them to problem solve with you, you're going to find all kinds of creative solutions you wouldn't have thought of on your own.
Mm-hmm. We actually problem solved with my sister on how to die. On how to turn loose. And mm-hmm. it was a wonderful gift, I think, for everyone who participated in that. Yes.
Exactly. Yeah. And what people tend to forget is they tend to think that the only person who benefits, and this is especially when the person is themselves the focus of the illness and attention, is they feel like they're burdening everybody and they're the only one who's getting anything out of this. But everybody around is learning and is getting all mm-hmm. kinds of things out of seeing creative ways of coming up with different ways of coping and
right.
of being in it together, not everybody in their corner, not looking while somebody's either dying or having to ask for help after a surgery.
Mm-hmm.
So it applies to both the mild and the severe.
Yes. I also want to bring up, though, I have had the experience with people who are not functioning well, people who are getting older, for example, mm-hmm. and my perception is, and I usually talk with them about this first, but my perception is there are certain things that they can still do for themselves. Mm-hmm. But they got to a place where they give up and they want me to do it for them. And when I say, I choose not to do that for you, that's something you can do for yourself. And if you don't wish to do it for yourself, then we'll skip it. Because I take a pretty hard line in there, that person will often get angry with me and then in my experience later go ahead and do what was on the table and feel better about themselves. But I have to deal with that anger first.
Yeah, it depends on the relationship and the people.
Uh-huh.
But that can often be very powerful. As a therapist, part of our job is to invite people to be angry with us because this is a situation where maybe the first time in their life where they know, at least we're trying to teach them, that they can safely get angry at us and we'll be there and still care about them the following week rather than abandon them because they got angry at us. And for many people, that's one of the healing factors of group and being in individual therapy.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole idea of eliciting people's help and to say, you know, I'm really not sure that you can't do that, and I really want you to do the most that you can. And when there are times when you can't do it, I'll do what I can to help with it.
Yes, that's
and
the framework with which
is the,
with
is
which
the framework. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And with all of these things, the more we talk about these things before the crisis hits,
mm-hmm.
the better. You can say, I mean, I went through this with both of my parents. I took care of each of them in many ways, especially my mother, as she was dying. And, you know, we had long conversations well before and then during, so that when she was asking for help, it was really clear that she needed it and mm-hmm. what it was like for her. And it allowed us to really talk honestly about the times when I was, you know, they call it compassion fatigue rather than burnout now. But there were times when it was just too much for me to be working and taking care of her. And I had to have caregivers take care of her. And we had talked about that in advance. She didn't want me burning out and damaging my health.
Mm-hmm.
So we had planned for how we were going to manage that. And most people don't do that. Because we don't talk about death and dying, and we don't talk about disability, we don't talk about limitations, even if they're just, you know, a runner who needs to have a knee replacement after running their knee out.
Well, by golly, with your help, we are talking about it today. I do appreciate it.
Uh-huh.
There, I want you to know that on the chat, the person to whom you gave those suggestions, her response is great ideas. So.
Oh, good.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Well, we could talk a long, long time about this.
Yeah.
You have a lot of wonderful things to offer. I certainly want to encourage people to check out all the resources and the medicine sheet that you have. You have articles on your website at drsteiner.com. And before we end, let me ask you, is there any last thing that you would like to tell people, either about dealing with their own chronic illness or about helping the people they care about to deal with chronic illness? What parting words would you like to give us?
Okay, that's a rich opportunity. Let's see. One thing I was thinking of as we were talking is a quote from Martin Luther King Jr. And he said, "As you press on with justice, be sure to move with dignity and discipline, using only the weapons of love." And
wow.
We've been talking about the anger that comes up for everybody dealing with limitations. And it's so easy to get stuck in anger and to lose compassion for ourselves and for others. And I notice that you also focus on compassion. And one of the ways I think about it is that compassion is contagious.
Mm-hmm.
And that the more compassion we have for ourselves and others, the better it is for everybody in dealing with these things. So those are
the can I stop you right there? Because
mm-hmm.
you said for ourselves, and I think that
mm-hmm.
really needs to be emphasized. We really have to have
mm-hmm.
compassion for ourselves before we can really give it
mm-hmm.
away to others.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. It's crucial. It's crucial. You know, one of the lessons that came out of the Oakland fire was one of the women who lost her house, her comment, and she did a tile about this in one of the healing groups that was done, that I think is in actually one of the BART stations, and it says, "Use your best china." And when I first saw it, I didn't quite understand what it meant. But I really like it once I've gotten clear about it, which is that most of us have favorite things that we, you know, like a grandmother left us a piece of china that we don't use because it's so beautiful. And her
mm-hmm.
point is, use it while you got it. Enjoy it. That's what it's there for. And it's a little bit like don't postpone joy, which is one of the phrases that I really like using, although I have noticed some people take advantage of it and live too much in the moment. So
uh-huh.
if anything, you don't want to do it in excess. But, you know, really living life to the fullest, given your limitations, is one of the best things that we can all do.
Mm-hmm. That's really true. Again, we have a question. Where can people find that quote from Martin Luther King Jr.?
Oh, boy. You know, I think one would need to Google it. I'm not sure. I found it when I was giving a talk and I went for a walk in New Orleans along the waterfront.
Oh.
Years ago.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I'm pretty sure that's where I found it. There were plaques with quotes.
Do you have it on the tip of your tongue? Could you say it again for us?
Oh, certainly. As you press on with justice, be sure to move with dignity and discipline, using only the weapons of love.
Thank you.
And
all
one
right.
of the other reasons I like that is that when we talk about illness, we tend to automatically use warrior language. We battle illness. We struggle. There was a skirmish. And there's so much weaponry language in dealing with illness that I particularly like using only the weapons of love.
I like that very much. Well, we could talk for
mm-hmm.
a long while on this, and I've really enjoyed talking with you.
Mm-hmm.
Let me remind our listeners that if you want more information about adding joy to the ride of chronic illness, go to Ann Steiner's website, which is drsteiner.com. And if you are a person who works with others with chronic illness, you will also benefit from her workbook, which is entitled Starting and Sustaining Groups That Thrive. And I know that's available on your website also. And whether you have a chronic illness or not, let me encourage you to bring joy to the ride. And I thank you for sharing your very personal journey and giving us such a great model for real full power living in the face of such challenge. So thank you for being with us on Full Power Living today.
My pleasure. This has been a real joy. Thank you.
All right. And thank you to our listeners. Listen next week when we explore the science and art of living deeply with researcher Dr. Marilyn Schlitz. I want to thank our wonderful producer, Paul Johnston of Fresh Talk Media, for his longtime care and support of us here at Full Power Living. And Paul, we are especially grateful for your health and dedication today. And from now, I'm Eileen Dillon, your host, reminding you, pay attention to what you want to become, not to what you want to overcome.
Living with Eileen Dillon.